Hey there, Tap Trailers. Dave Morales here. Thanks for tuning in to the Tap 10 podcast. This is an extension of the Bellingham Tap Trail. Today, we'll be sitting down with Chad. You know Chad, from Wander Brewing. With a last name that looks simple to pronounce, but you're pretty sure it can't be that simple? Well, it isn't. But today, dear listener, the truth shall be revealed. But first, today's Tap Trail conversation is brought to you by Hoppus Real Estate, specializing in Whatcom's core neighborhoods, understanding the wants, and fulfilling the needs with community, craft, and comfort in mind. Located at 1012 DuPont Street across from the Leonard Street's Coffee House. And you can find them on Facebook and Instagram. Wander Brewing came onto the scene in 2013 and immediately established itself as a brewery to be reckoned with, winning awards, soon implementing a barrel project, and continuing to fearlessly innovate and push style limits. Chad and I had a good time sitting down, getting to know each other, sampling some beers, and covering a lot of ground. Enjoy, and you and I will meet again sooner than you think. Thanks for coming.
Cheers for coming. Cheers. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Yeah. So first and foremost, because I tried very hard to get a consensus on this and no one could agree.
Oh boy.
What? For once and for all, for posterity.
Yep.
How do you pronounce your last name?
Keel.
Keel.
Keel, like the keel of a boat.
All right.
Kind of way. Yeah.
There you have it, people.
My grandfather was a German immigrant, came over on the boat in 1920, I believe was the year. And when he came in through Ellis Island, it was K-U-H-L, which is a Kuhl, but my German's terrible. I don't speak German or claim to. And the way he pronounced it and the way he said it, they added an E in. And the E seems to add a lot of confusion now, so people don't know. Mostly we get cool.
Cool.
You know, so people, you know, call on the phone or people inquire. They ask for Mr. or Mrs. Cool there. But it's Keel. And my grandpa ended up, immigrated to America, came to Iowa, and then opened Keel's Tavern, was the local tavern that was in the kind of like rural farming community I grew up in. So he owned that tavern for 39 years.
Nice.
And then when my brother and I were little, we kind of grew up in that tavern. So that was kind of our first touch on beer.
Right.
The last name was Keel, and there was a Keel's Tavern and so on. So yeah.
Right. I will say that nobody said that.
Okay.
They were like, I think it's cool. Maybe it's Kuel. Maybe it's cool.
Like people are throwing an extra syllable in there. Kuel or
Kuel. Yeah. Or just Kuel. Yeah. You know, something like that.
Keel. Yeah. Keel of a boat.
All right.
It's really actually good simpler than it looks.
I think you have just done a public service now.
There you go. Very good. Yeah.
All right. Let's get into the whole Wander deal. Just looking from your website, because we don't know each other that well. So it's funny. A lot of times I know the people, so I already know all the answers to everything that I'm going to ask.
But yep.
In this case, it's not so much the case, but I did a little bit of research and, you have quite the arc, into brewery ownership, it seems. And we can take it step by step. But at what point in your engineering career did you decide to drop it and attend the Brewers Guild? I mean, did you already have a dream of opening up a brewery? And I ask that because, you know, let's face it, brewer salaries are not on par with engineering salaries generally.
Yeah.
And going to school just isn't something that, you know, people would do on a lark.
No. And so I always loved math and science, and that's kind of where I gravitated toward with school, went to the University of Iowa, got an industrial engineering degree, worked on offshore oil rigs down in South America in Venezuela right out of school, realized that I do not need to be working on offshore oil rigs for a living. Colleen and I had started dating in college. We weren't married or anything, but
yeah, you met in college, right?
Met at the University of Iowa, and we're doing long distance. And realized that it was really kind of the climate down in Venezuela. It is now and then as well, wasn't really stable.
Right.
And it wasn't really safe. And Colleen was getting ready to move down there. I lived in a walled armed compound with a bunch of other oil workers, essentially. Mm-hmm. And decided that that probably wasn't the life that we wanted early on in adulthood. It was adventurous, but it wasn't really safe. And we're trying to figure out, you know, is it really going to get us toward where we want, what we wanted to do? And we decided to just pick everything up and move to San Francisco. So we moved to San Francisco, no jobs, nothing. At the time, this was 2004, mid 2004. big, crazy, expensive city. No jobs, but within 2 months we both had jobs and we're working. So I did tech consulting. So I worked for Accenture, which is like a big, mega, large consulting firm that you see on billboards and in airports and all that. And got into the tech scene down there and did tech consulting for about 10 years. Really enjoyed it. Eventually it led us to Seattle. We made a move to Seattle. We lived in Denver for a little while and then came to Seattle and got back into tech consulting there. But ultimately it was, I got a good 10 years worth out of my degree in that career. Even though industrial engineering and tech consulting aren't exact matches, but it was kind of the scientific degree and mindset, that worked well in that industry. Ultimately though, going and sitting at a desk every day, I just kind of do it. I want to be on my feet, which was originally why I was drawn to the work on the oil rigs. As you're on your feet, you're working with your hands, but I needed to, at the end of the day, have something
physically
that was,
doing something.
Yeah. I needed to be working with my hands. I needed something that was tangible. And Colleen and I originally, we got into craft beer when we lived in Northern California. We're drinking Sierra Nevada. There was a rogue ale house that was a couple blocks down the street from our apartment in North Beach, right in San Francisco. We served Anchor Steam at our wedding. That's beer of San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Just drank a lot of Anchor Steam. And we really started getting into kind of now what seems like old school craft beer.
Yeah.
And for a while, thought maybe we wanted to open a small like family run winery. I got really into wine actually before beer and then just kind of gravitated towards beer. And like most of us got really involved with homebrewing. And then one day said, hey, I think we could do this potentially for a living. And I don't want to sit at a desk all day. At the end of the day, the things I was delivering in tech consulting, I basically had this realization. I was working for the top employer that I would want to work for in Seattle. I was working at the Gates Foundation, which is an amazing place to work. I'd been there for I think just over 4 years. So I had the top client I could ever ask for and the top consulting firm I'd ever want to work for. And I still wasn't completely satisfied, even though I was surrounded with these great people doing great work. So that was kind of like, okay, we need to start working towards something that's going to be more fulfilling for us long-term.
Right.
So we decided it was a brewery and to pull the trigger on it. So yeah, I walked away. Both Colleen and I, Colleen worked for a global health nonprofit. She worked in women's reproductive health and she had a very good career with that. So we built up our careers and yeah, we walked away from
tore it down
from very good successful careers that we put a lot of effort and stress into. But those careers also enabled us to start the brewery and to get Wander going. So formerly was a tech engineer consultant career and then made the transition. So long winded answer.
Yeah, no, that's what we're here for.
Yeah, yeah.
All the details.
Yeah.
You didn't start homebrewing until you were in San Francisco.
Yeah, in San Francisco, we started homebrewing. There was a really old homebrew shop there that was ran by a gentleman who kind of sat in a big sofa and you'd walk in the front door and he would kind of call out to you, what are you looking for? And it's in this corner and that corner, kind of old homebrew shop.
Crusty.
And we're brewing on an old gas stove in a one bedroom apartment in San Francisco, making beer for our wedding, which was in 2007, making beer for friends, doing it all in bottles though. Didn't have a kegerator at the time or anything like that set up yet. Just doing 5 gallons at a time, putting it all into bottles and bottle conditioning and really just kind of got turned on to that way. And then that kind of eventually we made our way roundabout way to Seattle. We ended up purchasing a house in Ballard before the Seattle stock or Seattle real estate prices went insane. So we had a nice little kind of corner lot home in old fixer upper house in Ballard and turned that garage. The garage wasn't really feasible to drive a car into. It's kind of like a small garage or a big shed. Poured concrete floors in it, ran water and electric out to it and turned that into kind of the first Wander brewery, and hung up a sign that said Wander on it because we knew we wanted that name.
Nice. Yeah.
And started home brewing there inside that garage, had my water filtration set up and I had an actual brewing stand I got off of the kitchen, the kitchen stove, and then started doing 10 gallon batches, got the kegerator set up. So kind of then graduated. So at that point, first time we homebrewed was back in 2000, I think it was early 2007. And at that point, when I kind of graduated, went to the larger kind of setup in Ballard, that was 2011. So worked on that for a couple of years. In between San Francisco and Seattle, we took a trip overseas, Colleen and I. So we kind of saved up for several years and then went overseas for 13 months and just traveled. So we bought a round the world ticket. It had like 18 legs on it. It was surprisingly very affordable. People wonder how you do that. And it's like, I mean, we two of us traveled around the world for 13 months amazing experience for less than the price of a new SUV.
Yeah.
And, you know, people buy new cars here and there, and people say, well, how did you travel around the world for a year? Well, we saved up, and instead of buying a new car, we left our jobs and traveled around the world. Yeah. I mean, we were sleeping in, you know, not the nicest of places, and we were cramped on, you know, overcrowded buses in Africa, but mm-hmm. we just made our way around. Altogether, we spent around like $65 a day together,
yeah.
on two people.
Yeah.
And so if you figure that out, you don't need a huge budget. You just need to kind of go.
But yeah.
Anyways, that I kind of went on a tangent. Yeah.
Oh, there, I deal with people every day who have no idea how to travel.
Yeah. It's not that. Yeah. You just go and you figure it out as you go.
Yeah.
And you got to be flexible, and you got to be, you know, not have your mind set too much in a lot of parts of the world. But
yeah. One of my favorite things to say, like in my 20s, is like, well, what do you do when you're broke? It's like, go camping.
Yeah.
Like you're not going to spend any money,
no.
you know, or go travel, because you actually spend less money when you're traveling than you do
when you're in parts of the world where, yeah, where accommodations are anywhere from a handful of dollars to maybe $15 or $20. That's most of your expense, that, and then transportation. But you can go out to eat a lot of places, and beers, you know, are under a dollar, and your meal might be a dollar.
Mm-hmm.
You can live pretty cheap, you know?
Yeah.
But, I don't even know if I answered the question, Dave. Where were we talking?
Well, yeah, I think you did. I asked when you started homebrewing. Yeah. And then the follow-up was, when did you get serious about it? But I'd say when you're pouring concrete slabs and running water filtration things.
The reason
things,
I brought up
you're
the,
serious.
Where I kind of digress into the trip, that's when I applied to brewing school. So that trip, it was in between San Francisco and Seattle. So that trip was in, we left early 2009, came back in 2010. For reference point, we got the brewery building, mid 2013.
Right.
But I applied to brewing school, when we left for the trip, early 2009, I actually filled out the application, everything. We were in Africa backpacking, and fill out the application, all the paperwork, had to send in prerequisites, which I had them all for engineering, which was great. So I had to say, you know, I had taken so many semesters of chemistry and biology, and I had taken so many semesters of calculus. And so I fulfilled all the pre-requirements for the American Brewers Guild, applied to it. And then there was a 2-year wait list.
Mm.
So I applied in early 2009. I actually didn't go to start brewing school. I think it was June of 2011. So while I was working or building out the home brew setup in our backyard in this kind of oversized shed, I then started taking the American Brewers Guild. It's a 6-month class, correspondence.
Correspondence, yeah.
So you take everything correspondence. You have an actual class they do. I don't know if they've changed it, but they do two classes of 24 each year. So 48 students a year. And you get to know all the students in your class, but you haven't met any of them. Some of them are working brewers. But we had a couple working brewers from down in Bend. We had brewers from Mexico, brewers from all over the place. Mm-hmm. But then once you get to the end of the course, the last couple weeks, you're out in Vermont. And at this time, they've now built an actual brewery and an actual facility that students come and brew at. You take final exams and do all that. They didn't have that at the time when I was taking it. So we actually stayed in housing in an old ski on the side of an old ski resort. We rented a house, me and a bunch of the other students. And we actually brewed at Harpoon. Mm. So if you're from the East Coast or been on the East Coast or that part of the country, you know, Harpoon's kind of like a large regional brewer, mm-hmm. kind of a Red Hook-esque size.
Yeah, like
brewery.
A pyramid kind of thing.
Exactly. So went to the American Brewers Guild course then. So still brewing in the backyard, wrapped up that course. And then the month I wrapped that up, I got in at Hilliard's Beer, which is just down the really down the street. It was probably close to a mile down the hill from our house in Ballard.
They're no more, right?
They're no more. Yeah. So they were open for close to 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then they ended up, the business kind of ended up folding and ceasing for whatever business reason. And
so many reasons.
Lagunitas bought up the building, and Lagunitas now has their small production facility and tap room in the old Hilliard's building. But I was working down at Gates Foundation in Seattle Center, right by the Space Needle. And then we had our house in Ballard, and Hilliard's was almost halfway in between
the
two, a little over halfway in between the two. And so I'd work, do tech consulting during the day. And then at night on the way home on my bike ride, I'd deviate over a couple blocks out of my way, stop at Hilliard's, help out with anything I could there, serve some beers in the tasting room, clock out at 10 or 10:30, ride the bike up the hill, go to sleep. So it was just kind of
a good flavor for the hours.
It was good.
And what you have to do.
I wasn't able to do a full time, you know, 40-hour work week at the brewery, but I was able to take the brewing education I had, plus actually be at Hilliard's for 2 years working part-time and see how stuff actually went down and see the things that were important and
having that hands-on experience, it helps a lot before you go to to school.
And 100%. You know. Yeah, there were students in our class that definitely had, a foot up on everyone just because they were working brewers and they were taking the class.
The practicalities of the theory.
Oh, yeah. And there's so, like, once I got into Hilliard's and started, this is a centrifugal pump. And, this is like what we were talking about in class, but I had nothing to compare it to. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you're reading through all these textbooks at brewing school and watching all these videos, the whole hands-on real life, if you've seen it before, so valuable.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I've read a million times about caustic, but I've never actually pumped it out of a jug and diluted it and ran a cycle. But I wish for anyone that is thinking about going to brewing school, gosh, if you can get in at a brewery, even just washing kegs, washing bottles, doing whatever,
or even just standing in the corner and watching,
watching or working a couple shifts up in the front tasting room, but you still have that, you're in that environment, mm-hmm. Hugely valuable. I wish I could have worked somewhere before brewing school, and I got a ton out of brewing school, but I think it would even be more valuable.
So you had already gone?
I'd already went to brewing school.
Okay. All right. Before you went.
No, when I entered brewing school, I'd been a homebrewer for about 4 years, mm-hmm. went to brewing school for 6 months. And then right when I graduated from the American Brewers Guild, I started at Hilliard's part-time same month.
All right. I had the timeline backwards.
Yeah. But, I think it's viable. Me personally, people ask, what is brewing school essential to start your own brewery? Cause a lot of questions I get for people who want to start their own brewery. Is it essential? And is it essential that I work in a brewery? I don't think either one of them is, but the two together are going to help.
Did they cover a lot of business side of things, or was it just the science? No,
it was just the science, fermentation science, engineering, that sort of thing. I did take a small business certificate from Cal Berkeley, though. It was like a 7-course thing I took mm-hmm. when I was in San Francisco working tech. I took that in evenings, another like part-time evening thing, evening classes. And that taught me a lot. And then Colleen there's a business of craft brewing certificate at Portland State, and Colleen took that as well. Okay. So that kind of helped us with the small business stuff. And while we were traveling too, when I applied to brewing school, that whole year we were traveling, we wrote the business plan for Wander. It's so much different than how Wander turned out.
Always.
It had us thinking stuff out, and we had a lot of time to think and prepare. And it's like, Wander opened in early 2014. We got the building mid 2013. But it's one, and Dave, mm-hmm. from your experience, I mean, my word, at that point, a lot of time and effort had been put into it for several years. Mm-hmm. It's not a 6 or 12 or 18 month thing. I mean, we'd been working on it for 36, 48 months pretty consistently.
Yeah. It's a commitment in time and effort. You know, you're either all in or you're not.
Yep.
Speaking from experience, you have to be honest with yourself. You know, if it's mm-hmm. time to say no, and do it, because otherwise you're just going to be sad.
Yep. And the crazy thing is too, with the opening of the brewery, one of the things that we learned, and what I tell a lot of people who are looking at starting their own breweries, and they're in it, and they're like, people who do pull the trigger and the headaches and stuff they're going through. And so I keep everything in perspective, you know, make a checklist one thing at a time. But honestly, the real stress starts once the brewery opens. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's building a brewery.
I remember you guys being there all the time.
Yeah. Building the brewery out is stressful, but you're really on no one's timeline except your own. Yeah. You might have a contractor coming in that's dependent on another contractor finishing something, but if it gets delayed, it's really just kind of, you're on your own schedule, and how quickly you can get things checked off and get through it, the sooner you get open. Once mm-hmm. you open, you then have the dynamic of the general public, people's opinions. Mm-hmm. You have employees, we have 14 employees right now.
Wow.
You have, how many vendors are you dealing with? You're now dealing with malt vendors, hop vendors, chemical vendors, mm-hmm. Compressed air and gas vendors, all this stuff. When you're building out, you're usually dealing with a plumber, an electrician, mm-hmm. and maybe a flooring specialist or a concrete person.
Yeah.
It's definitely extremely stressful and a ton of work, but once you get the doors open, I mean, it doesn't slow down.
Yeah. Especially if you're doing, like, I remember you guys bartending and, obviously you were the brewer. Does Colleen brew?
Colleen was our, when we first opened, we didn't have any employees for the first, what was it?
Wild.
About 90 days, about 3 months.
Oh, was it only that long? Okay. Seemed longer, but I don't remember.
It might have been 6 months. Ago. I think it was 3 months, because then Matt Shannon and Steve DeMoney came aboard to help us out with some cellar work and working up front and delivering beer. Mm-hmm. I think it was 90 days. It could have been six. I'm pretty sure it was 90 days. It's been 5 years now, and it's been a long time, but not that long, but so much has happened. I think it was only 90 days though, Dave, only. But that was 90 days of we would wake up, go in, mill in at 6 a.m., brew all day long, scramble to get the taste room open by 3 o'clock, and then shut down the taste room at 9 p.m. Hopefully we're home by 10 or 10:30. So it was going in at 6, coming back at 10, and we were open. We did take, we were closed originally Monday and Tuesday, I think, at the onset. So that was 5 days a week of those days. And then on Monday and Tuesday, you're just trying to catch your breath and fix stuff. But Colleen was the original assistant brewer seller person. She, the first, it was the first couple months. So probably the first, 30, 40 brews. She did the mash tun. She raked out all the grain. She pulled out grain totes. She did all that, sprayed down on the floor. So she knows the brewing process. I mean, Colleen probably doesn't get super excited about diving into the intricacies, but she can brew, and she's sat in on recipe development, and she's raked out the mash tun. She's done all that. And then she's done her fair share in the tasting room too. Mm-hmm. So yeah, but now she's the other half of Wanda, right? I handle production and Colleen handles the business side. So she settles all
that's
our
important.
Books.
Yeah.
Hugely important.
You know, thing that you can trust somebody, like, I think about it, but I don't have to worry about it.
No, you don't. And that's one thing. Sometimes it's like, well, is this something we should be, hiring out? But Colleen, she does have a passion for it, even though there's a lot of stress generated by the backside of the brewery.
Yeah. It is a business.
It's something that she has a talent for it, and it takes the stress off. It's obviously someone you can trust. It's your other owner.
Right.
And it's easy to sync with them. Now on the flip side, we're a married couple that are the only owners of a small business. You it's hard to step away and separate.
There's no
true
downtime.
You take it home with you, and you always
how was your day at work, honey? Well,
because we were trying to figure out this bill all day long or whatever it was. So that's on the flip side. So we've set boundaries with that. We've given other people that have asked for advice, other couples who own small businesses, Colleen and I, this blows people's minds. We don't talk about Wander at home.
Yeah.
Unless we're in the office, or we can talk about it in the car, but you need the separation. We can't talk about when we're making food for dinner. Mm-hmm. We can't talk about it when we're playing, in the basement with our daughter, or when we're, hanging out on the porch or whatever. It's, if we're going to talk business, we gotta go in the office and talk about it. Cause otherwise it's too easy to A, spend too much time on it, and B, get frustrated, because work is still work. It's frustrating. Yeah. It's a hard
You're
job.
You're running a business.
Yeah. You don't want to.
You're running a factory.
It's like, I'm trying to zone out, or Colleen's trying to zone out and make dinner and enjoy family time. And if you bring that into your home, that can be difficult. Yeah. So we try and set boundaries that say we can talk about work here and here. We don't talk about it here. Otherwise it's all consuming. I mean, you go on vacation, you talk about work. You go to wash the car, you talk about work. You go on a walk at sunset to try and ease your mind at the end of the day, you talk about work. You're falling asleep at night and your spouse is next to you and your own business, work comes up.
Yeah, it's easy to let it be all consuming. Exactly. Yeah, that's good. That's really good advice to have those boundaries. Yeah. It occurred to me, one of my firm beliefs is that brewers, and especially professional brewers, tend to be detail oriented and process oriented.
Yep.
I know that I am, for sure. And you, it seems like you're a perfect case
Colleen,
with your engineering background.
Yeah, for an engineer, I'm oddly not super detail-oriented. I'm a numbers guy. I'm a very analytical, which I think is different than detail-oriented. Colleen sweats the details in the fine print. I'm very analytical, but I need checklists and I need organization to make sure that the production side of Wander goes really well. But I'm not a super detail oriented guy, oddly, but Colleen is hyper detail oriented.
Right.
So it's a good mix. I'm very analytical. I'm always thinking about numbers. But a lot of times I'm thinking big pictures numbers, and I'm not always thinking about the fine print, which is probably something I can work on, but it's working for now.
Yeah,
but for being an engineer
working,
brewer, I'm not as detail oriented as you might think.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. All right. What memories, I'm just going to go back to your initial homebrew days here. What memories do you have of your very first brew?
Very first brew. Yeah. Oh, wow. So we live in San Francisco. We went backcountry camping in Yosemite, myself and two friends back from the University of Iowa. And one of those, actually just one friend from University of Iowa, and then one of his friends from high school. So Joe, who, and I hadn't met Joe before, but Joe was an avid homebrewer. And we talked about homebrewing all weekend. And we ended up camping in a backcountry campground called Vogelsang, up at like 10,000 feet in Yosemite for the weekend. And Joe kept talking about homebrewing because he was obsessed with it. You know, we're 24-year-old, 25-year-old guys. Well, actually, it was 2007. We're 26-year-old guys. And I was like, wow, this is pretty cool and amazing. I was already kind of really interested in fermentation, more interested in kind of the wine side of fermentation. And Joe was talking about all weekend, got me excited about it. So on the way home, we stopped at a homebrew shop, not the couch guy homebrew shop, but a different homebrew shop. And Joe picked up all the ingredients. They had a flight. Their flight wasn't until the following morning after we got back. So we drove back from Yosemite, picked up ingredients, brewed that afternoon.
Nice.
And did our first batch of beer. And it was like Vogelsang, where we say it was Vogelsang Amber Ale.
Right, sure.
Wasn't bad. Wasn't great. But I was kind of hooked then. But, you know, that was classic 5 gallons. On an old gas
stove. Partial extract or all grain?
It was all extract.
All extract.
Yeah. Well, not all extract, mostly extract and a couple of specialty
pour on a bag. Yeah.
That sort of thing.
And were your first brews that, or when did you go all grain? Was it pretty quick
all
turnaround?
All grain? No, I didn't go all grain for a while, not in San Francisco. I think it was just out of pure simplicity of our setup there. Yeah. I didn't actually start doing all grain.
Taking away 3.5 hour brew days.
Yes. Yeah.
It's hard.
Yeah. No, we kept everything simple in San Francisco. Once we got to Seattle, got the bigger setup, then we moved to all grain then. But,
yeah. And is that, I'm guessing that that's probably when you noticed your skills take a pretty noticeable jump once you started having more control over things.
Yeah. And at that time, you know, up to that point, I wasn't filtering my water. I wasn't really interested in water chemistry as much.
It's usually the last thing.
Yeah. Yes. Water chemistry, mash temperatures, when you're just boiling extract, it's pretty straightforward. So, that's when we're able to dial stuff in, but more, I mean that when you go to all grain, it takes a little bit more time to get stuff dialed in. I think my quality wise from an end, you know, my neighbor buddy trying my beer probably took a little dip there before I could kind of get the hang of it. Mm-hmm. I remember my first couple of batches, I had terrible efficiencies. You know, I was running out gravities that were well below where they were supposed to be, you know, just, I didn't have my technique down, you know, and I was trying to like fly sparge in this cooler.
And
that
every system's a little different too.
Exactly.
You know? So it takes a while. I mean, you know, whenever a new brewery opens and you're trying the,
trying the beer. Here we go.
Trying the beer. But you know, the first batches of beer, I wasn't at Boundary at the very, very beginning, but you know, every brewery goes through that, you know, like, well, we need to release this. And, you know, and it's, of course, assuming you're like every other brewer, you're like, well, it's not quite what I want it to be. Like, I tend to be like super over apologetic about like, well, it's not really what I wanted, but
I'm always harder on myself.
Than
we've started to let some of our other brewers, Lou or Lee Brewer, has been designing beers for a while. Now Eric and Eric are two. We have three brewers and two of them are named Eric. Eric and Eric are starting to design beers now too. Mm-hmm. And this is actually a beer that Eric, it's a grapefruit IPA.
Being released today, President's Day?
February 18th. Yes. Yeah. So we start to let them design more beers and they're making great beers, and I oversee it and review everything. They're making
CBO.
Great beers.
Yeah,
but I'm way harder on myself than I am on other people. And I think my employees would probably, I hope, support that. But I'm definitely my biggest critic, but I'm definitely more forgiving for others. Maybe I see it as something that's teachable, or I don't know. But yeah, definitely. I think all good brewers are always kind of your suggestion, Dave. They're
your
always,
own worst critic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's how you make great beer. You always, you know, most of our beers, we don't only make one time. We might only make them one time a year. A lot of our beers come around once a year and then we repeat the next year, but we always tweak it.
Yeah.
And we have beers that have won medals at GABF, gold medals at GABF. We're still tweaking them.
Yeah.
Why are you touching it? Well, because something changed. We brewed it this last time and we think this little thing needs tweaked on it.
Yeah.
Now we're not like changing, you know, whole bags of malt, but you tweak stuff. We think when you go down one degree in mash temperature, or you know, we think that last addition of hops needs to be 4.5 pounds instead of 5. I mean, it's little tweaks.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where it's fun to dork out if you're into that being a dork.
Yeah.
Which I totally am. Yeah, I see beers like songs. You know, they're never done. They're never finished. You know, just because a song is released on an album that way, it doesn't mean that it's not still in flux.
Yep.
And just because a beer is released doesn't mean that it's not going to be tweaked a little bit.
You know? Exactly.
I really like the fact that you got
that. It's a good analogy. I like that.
Yeah. I like the fact that your pale ale of sorts, Wander Ale, is a Belgian.
Yep.
Like,
yep.
It's because we were going to do something like that.
Yes.
You know, it's like, nope, I'm all about Belgians.
Yep. Yeah. It's really interesting and kind of the analogy you just made, but too, with recipes, people, you can have that great recipe. I mean, you can find, You can go find the recipe for, you know, whatever your favorite beer is, Pliny or whatever it is. You can't replicate it though. I mean, yeah, it's the brewery, it's the equipment, it's the process, it's the attention to detail. Yeah. Even if I'm not a super detail
tank person, dimensions.
Yes. You know, I got a brew sheet in front of me for a reason. I file that thing religiously to a T.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have to worry about those details, but it's the people brewing the beer. It's the equipment it's brewed on. It's the source water, even though we all have some more than others, fancy water filters. It's the way we adjust our water. It's all of that. It's the grain supplier. Where's your Munich coming from? Is it Weirmann? Is it Great Western? Is it RAR? Where's all that stuff? It's really hard to replicate one thing from one place to another. And that's why breweries have that issue. You know, you got a West Coast brewery and you build an East Coast brewery and it tastes different. Well, there's so many factors beyond a recipe. So many factors. Tank geometry, you said, Dave, is a huge one.
Is it direct fire? Is it steam? You know, are you getting any caramelization?
All of that stuff.
All of that stuff. Yeah.
Yep, definitely.
Little details. How quickly are you? You know, how long are you whirlpooling? You know, are you whirlpooling?
Exactly.
Surprise. Told you I'd be back sooner than you thought. We have a new sponsor here at Tapped In, and we are very excited to welcome Skagit Valley Malting into the fold. Skagit Valley Malting is an independent local craft malt house dedicated to sustainable farming practices and the use of superior maritime grains. Imported and commodity malts make a lot of beer, but craft malt makes craft beer. Using their patented technology, Skagit offers breweries a diverse variety of customizable malts that offer distinction in a crowded marketplace. So why import? They can provide what you're looking for right here, together.
So I just want to talk about the name Wander, because I really like the fact that the name Wander really represents both of you and your overall philosophy. And I just want you to talk a little bit about how your travels and your overall approach to life informs how Wander approaches not only the business aspect of it, but also the beers that you create under that name.
Yeah. So Wander, we came up with it early on. We knew we wanted kind of like a strong, simple name. This is kind of like the heyday of Rogue, you know, and Rogue's still a great brewery, but there was a time there West Coast, it was like Rogue and Sierra and Deschutes, you know, and we lived a few blocks from the Rogue Public Ale House. I love the name Rogue. I was like, it's so strong, powerful. Yeah. It's, you know, it's five letters. I want like one or two syllables, strong word, keep it short and simple. So we're knocking around ideas. Then one day it just came to me, Wander, and it seemed to fit. And you start Google searching and no one's using it yet. So, So then you get the trademark process going and all that. So we hopped onto it and we feel like it embodies kind of a lot of what we've done in life. You know, Colleen and I, we've taken a couple of big trips and traveled a lot. We've kind of made ourselves, worked our way out to the West Coast, then back to Denver and then up to Seattle and then eventually up to Bellingham. So it kind of embodies a lot of kind of our, kind of what, I guess kind of our mindset as adults. So we're wanderers and we like taking long weekends and traveling places and checking out new places. And we like finding the unfamiliar and exploring and all that. So it captured that. And then from a beer standpoint, it really captures what we do at Wander, which is anything under the sun that motivates us. So I don't think I've ever had a beer. I can think of one. But I think there's one beer that I told our brewers, I'm like, no, I don't think we'll be able to sell that. We're not going to design that. But and it was a sour stout, which we could. The thing is, one of the downfalls of a 20 barrel system is unless you want to do a half batch, which when we're at capacity,
30.
No, we have it with 20.
20. Barrel. Okay.
But we're running at capacity. Doing a half batch, you don't want to do when you're running capacity. And so we have close to 40 kegs of anything we make.
It's a big roll of the dice. Yeah.
That's 40 kegs of sour stout you're going to have to figure out. Mm-hmm. But really, most anything under the sun, I'll let my brewers brew.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I have to give some feedback like, hey guys, you know how this all works here. Like we have to sell this. Like, do you honestly think this will, I mean, are you confident or am I going to be looking at you in 3 months?
How would you market this to the public?
Yeah. Oh, you want to make that
make
style?
The pitch. Make
that's
going
to be hard to sell. Yeah. So you better come up with a really clever name and sell me on it. And then maybe you can sell me on making 20 barrels of Rauch beer. Okay, we got to call it Dwayne the Rauch Johnson so that it catches people's eyes on a menu.
Yeah.
So that they say, hey, maybe I should try that out. And that's kind of craft beer right now. So much of it is Dave and I are drinking a hazy pineapple IPA right now.
Which is delicious, by the way.
Well, cheers. Thank you. But this is what, from a wholesale perspective, you can sell
easily.
And
built-in market.
Exactly. And I think there's a lot to be said about breweries opening now that are tap room only focused, that are focusing on some more elaborate, not elaborate, some more exotic styles. But anyone who hopes to distribute beer and to, you know, to work themselves up to that 2, 3, 4, 5, 6,000 barrels a year, it's difficult to do on the same, in the same mindset of what a lot of brewers want to do right now, which is barrel age focused, farmhouse, sour, fruited.
Yeah. You're almost running a winery at that point. Like, this is a, we're brewing this now,
yes,
but it's a year out before it's going to be available. And
there's not a huge market right now out there for people that want to buy $300 kegs of beer. People want their 175, I'm talking about retail accounts. Want their $175 half barrel of beer that they can turn around and sell for $6 a pint. That's what they want. And as brewers and brewery owners, we live in a bubble where we're hyper surrounded by people that are sour beer fanatics and farmhouse fanatics and those of us who like Belgian ales and those of us who like worship Orval and all this stuff. But
and then the people that just want their hops.
But then it's easy to lose sight because we go to Elizabeth Station all the time, or we drink at Wander or Kolschen or Aslin or
we're Boundary. So spoiled.
We're spoiled, but so you, spoiled. We lose sight of still that 95% of the people are getting a pint of beer with their pizza at La Fiamma, and they just want to, they just want a house IPA. You know, they don't, and we need to make the beer for the 5%, but you can't lose sight. A lot of times I do read about new places opening, and I'm kind of like, that's going to, I'll be interested to see how that plays out, you know, because the craft beer consumer right now, they're loving lagers. They're starting to move toward lagers and well-done lagers and Pilsner's lagers. And then hops, you know, it's everywhere.
It's still hops.
And we had a big swing toward East Coast hazy stuff. And it seems like it's kind of coming back now. You're starting to see like a lot of breweries that were doing hazy stuff. Now they're coming back and doing like, oh, back to the West Coast. So I think there's a nice balance there.
Well, right now that there's the Brute thing out there. Yeah, and the Brute thing. It's like, oh, let's add some families and, you know, just drop it.
Yeah, we're fortunate in Washington. I know Lou, our lead brewer who moved out from Chicago. When I interviewed Lou, it's funny. He grew up in Dubuque and I grew up in Eldridge, which are about an hour from each other. When I looked at his resume, he had the same area.
Is that
code.
Iowa? I know Dubuque's Iowa. I don't know Eldridge.
Eldridge is Iowa too.
Okay.
But same area code that I grew up in. I was like, who in the heck is this guy? So it's kind of funny, but he moved out and I took him out to Yakima not long after he moved out here. He'd only been out for a few months and his mind was just blown. You know, fresh hop festival.
Bale hops and bales of hops everywhere.
It's easy to kind of forget about that. I mean, we brew in a part of the country where all these hops are grown. 75% of the national, you know, acreage of hops is in Yakima. We, a lot of the major malting warehouses and some of the facilities are down in Vancouver. So we have malt right by us. We have Skagit Valley just barely to the south of us. We have the climate that can grow, you know, world-class malt.
Yeah. And those guys are changing the game.
Yes. We have all the big yeast suppliers on the West Coast are mostly down in the Hood River, Portland area. They're all close by. I mean, everything we source is pretty much within our state or barely across the border. Obviously all of our water comes from here and all of that, but we definitely produce. There's not many parts of the country where the hops, the water, the yeast, the malt is as hyper local as it is here.
Yeah, the supply chain is so concentrated.
It's so tight. I mean, I'm sure some of our malt that gets blended into some of our standard two-row malt that we use in a lot of our beers might be coming from, you know, Saskatchewan or the Dakotas or some of that, but a lot of it's really high. It's really a pretty hyper local product. We're not brewing in, you know, Florida, not to pick on Florida, but you know, where your hops and your malt and your yeast, I'm guessing, are
coming across country.
All coming across country. So it's really
how does that affect? How does that affect flavor due to freshness factors?
That's
an interesting point. Yeah.
It's neat. And now we're trying all the spontaneous stuff too, which we're working on, which now we're trying to really make it really hyper local and see what we have, you know, within the air here, but it's fun.
That's exciting. Well, now that GP's not here, it's probably a lot better.
Definitely.
Projects, you know, so Wander, you went all in on the barrel thing pretty early and just immediately knocked it out of the park. You know, you took home awards from like Australia and you know, all over the place. It seems like you already had a clear vision of what you wanted to accomplish. And as you know, fermenting in barrels is far different from fermenting in stainless. Definitely. It's a little unpredictable. You know, it's more of a true living entity. And I'm just wondering what your ultimate goal is on that. I know that, you know, you refer to it as the barrel project.
Yep.
Is it something that you, do you see it as something that it will continue to grow in different ways? Or are you pretty happy with where it's at now and you're just kind of playing around with the things that already exist in it?
It's kind of evolving. I think we're going to have less small format barrels. And by small format, I mean your standard size barrels. We're loving what we're getting out of the fooders right now. Mm-hmm. The fooders we can...
You have two?
We have two of them. Yeah. Well, we have three. We have an open top too, but the open top we do short. We'll do a fermentation in stainless steel for a handful of days after we hit high Krausen and stuff kind of like settles down for a day. We'll transfer over and finish it out in oak in the open top. We have two closed top fooders that we're getting a lot of great flavors and respectable turnaround time out of. We're having beers come out of there that we feel are complex and we're really happy with at like 9 months.
Wow.
Where a lot of our barrel aged beers in the small format, they're new barrels coming in. They're used barrels, but new to us, that we're trying to get dialed in and inoculate them with certain bacteria, and our beers, you know, we're getting happy with them, but they're taking 18 to 24 months. We're just seeing more consistency in the fooder. It's one large vessel. Now that whole large vessel could go bad very quickly. but we're pretty tight on our quality standards and, and we watch everything closely. We sample it regularly. So I think we're going to be having less wine barrels and focusing more on the fooder beers. But stuff like Wild Warehouse, which is the beer that won a GABF, won a Golden, wooden barrel aged beer at GABF, that will always stay in smaller format Chardonnay barrels. We do a Flanders Red that'll always be in small format barrels. All of our wild beers that we take out of the cool ship, which sit in barrels for several years. We've only released one beer and we've been cool shipping for, I think, 2.5 years now.
Yeah. So talk a bit about for people who don't understand what a cool ship is. That's pretty exciting. You're the only brewery that I know of in Washington that has that. You know, when I think cool ship, I think Belgium.
Cool ship. Yeah. You're starting to see more. Rubens just got one. Floodland got one a little while ago down in Seattle. I think out on the east side, there's a couple people that have gotten them.
Because you had Chris Baker make it, right?
Chris did, local fabric.
Yeah,
Chris helped on a couple of the parts of it. There's a place called Indeco, which is out by the airport, who Chris actually used to work with.
Right.
Or work for. They did the major fabrication. Then Chris has helped us with all sorts of stuff. I mean, there's a lot. Yeah, for everyone who doesn't know, Chris Baker's a local stainless fabricator who's very talented. And he did a lot of our hard process piping at the brewery, connecting vessels to vessels that we didn't want to use flexible hosing on. So he hard piped in a lot of that. We got the cool ship going. We'll be going into our third summer now. So I think 3 years this summer. It's been a process. We usually do two or three a year, some in the fall, some in the spring. So cool ship's basically a large open top vessel,
giant shallow bathtub.
Exactly. Yeah. Ours will hold a full batch of beer. So ours is a little bit deeper than is traditional.
Yeah. It's good size. I mean, it takes up a lot of space.
We made it the size though, that it was basically, we made as large as we could make it, but still fit it on a trailer behind a truck. And then made it as deep as it needed to be to hold 20 barrels essentially. So we've towed it to different breweries to do collabs and that sort of thing.
Oh,
but,
nice.
But we'll brew during the day, standard brew day, going to the cool ship in the afternoon. So we're going in the cool ship hot. We're not going through heat exchanger at all. So it's going in there just below boiling, you know, roughly 205 degrees into the cool ship, sits overnight, cools down to somewhere around 75 to 80 degrees Fahrenheit, depending on how cool it is that night. We have garage doors on either end of the brewery that we roll open. So we get a nice breeze that blows through. And we just let the beer cool down to basically a temperature that bacteria and wild yeast can thrive in. So we basically use this big shallow vat to catch wild yeast and bacteria.
Is it a specific time of the year that you're doing it?
We do it fall and spring. Yeah. That's traditional. If you get too warm in the summer, you get stuff floating around the air that you don't want in your beer. You get too cold of days and there's not enough of the active good stuff floating around. So you kind of try and hit those sweet spots. Those kind of like,
always a breeze here.
Shoulder seasons. There's always a breeze and we're right on a creek too. So we get a nice right on Whatcom Creek. So we get a nice breeze kind of blowing through there.
Have you ever tried to take water out of there? And like,
we have not.
Yeah. I'm just curious as to how that would roll. I mean, obviously you need to process it, but
yeah, we have not tried that. That'd be just a thought. I mean, obviously our water comes from the watershed, not too far away, but yeah, the creek would be interesting. But then everything cools down. At that point, we have wild yeast and bacteria, 100% spontaneous. There's kind of right now, there is a lot, some different spontaneous out there on the market, but some people just make spontaneous beer. They run through a cool ship, then they inoculate it with lab cultures, you know, and we've toyed with some of that. But like the beer we have out right now, Act One, which is kind of a creek style spontaneous beer, that's 100% spontaneous. That's all Whatcom native yeast floating around. Nice.
Have you had it tested? Do you know what the yeasts are?
No. The only thing we've tested on it, the only thing we need to send to a lab. We had a vendor came out with some Anton Parr, which is a scientific instrument company, came out and we tested. The only thing we actually tested to a specific degree was the bottle conditioning we did on it, which it was at like 3.2 volumes, which is like 30% higher than our standard beers are carbed at, which is fun. It has this nice, we want it that high. Sure. We have them in these kind of fancy small champagne bottles, but it's very effervescent, very dry. We need to send it off and see if we can figure out what's in it. But
that would kind of spoil the fun too, a little bit.
And people are like, well, are you going to capture certain yeast and reuse it? There's a couple like Garden Path is doing, isolate a strain that tastes amazing that they really like. Ours is kind of spontaneous. When you drink that beer, it is the flavor that was in the air on that night. In that year that
pure
we had the
Bellingham. Going. Oh no, wait, yes. That's another brewery.
Yeah, there you go. But then like next year's, even if we do the same recipe, it's going to be much different. We're going to catch other things on that.
Yeah,
now it's probably going to be pretty similar.
How many people sneezed in Whatcom County today?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. So stuff goes in the barrels then, and then it sits in the barrel. So we go right off the cool ship straight into the barrels, fill the barrels. And then, yeah, the beer will sit in there for 1, 2, 3 years. I think we still have a couple of barrels that are from our original batches of the cool ship, the original year. I don't know if we have any from the first one. I think we have some from we did one, I think in September and one in December. I think we have a couple left from the December one, but we just kind of let them evolve. We've dumped a fair amount of spontaneous beer just because some barrels take off and some don't.
Yeah.
Different batches. So yeah, I mean, more so than a normal barrel age release where we have, let's say, 8 physical wine barrels full of beer, we might, usually we'll keep all 8. Every now and then we'll have like one that we dump, which might happen every couple releases. Mm-hmm. With the spontaneous beer, we have a couple of barrels out of each release that we dump. So it might be 25%, 30%. Yeah. There's a lot of loss there.
Yeah. It's the risk of doing that.
Yeah. We don't make a lot of it and you sell it at a premium price. And we get a lot of excitement out of it. It's unique. It's fun. It's as local as you get. And people are like, oh, is this something that like the direction you're gonna take the brewery in the future? And it's like, no, it's something that makes us excited. Mm-hmm. It makes our brewers excited. It's challenging. It's not simple. It's not straightforward.
Yeah. It's a part of what we do.
Yeah. But it's experimental too. And it's exciting for brewers who are very regimented and follow your SOPs and your recipes to a T every time. When you are now allowed to go a little off the page a little bit and experiment, it's fun and it's exciting. You know, it's the same reason we got the horizontal lagering tank that we got in last month. People are like, are you going to become a lager house now? Are you going to start pumping out a lot of lager? And it's like, no, we just got
not a lot.
We're going to do a little bit more. And we got this vessel because we think we can make better lager with it. Mm-hmm. And it makes us excited. And my brewers love making lager. And this is a vessel that people traditionally would use to make it. And it's fun and it's exciting for us.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily the direction we're going, but it's something that keeps us motivated and keeps us going.
Yeah. So, yeah, totally. Yeah. So shifting gears a little bit, you know, this is an industry that seems to be always in flux and it seems to be in pretty severe flux right now.
Yep.
You know, if things are happening on a large scale, you know, old stalwarts are falling. You know, I just read this week that Bridgeport and there was another one in Portland.
Oh, Burnside.
Burnside.
Yeah, which is a decent size.
Yeah, yeah. You know, they're done. Do you think, I'm just wondering what your thoughts are. Like, is today's status quo sustainable because the old guard is falling in some cases, but the newcomers are just, you know, they keep coming. Yeah. I guess, do you think that it's sustainable and what do you think And that's a kind of a multi-tiered question. Like, how do you think this will affect the overall camaraderie of the brewing community, which I see as a great community? Like, that's what I miss the most is the brewing community.
And, definitely.
And just everybody looking out for each other. I mean, I guess it's that. And then along with that, like, how do you see the state of beer in the United States right now? You know, how do you see things changing in 5, 10, or 15 years? That's a giant question.
But. Yeah. Yeah. And one, obviously, I don't have a perfect answer to you. I know the camaraderie I can speak to on a local level. When we opened, there were 3 breweries. Aslan and us opened right around the same time. So we went to 5 quickly. And those right now are kind of, from a volume standpoint, are kind of the big 5. And we're the smallest of those. Being Boundary Bay, Chuckanut, Colshan, ourselves, and Aslan. And we're the smallest of all those by a decent amount. Chuckanut's a little larger than
us. What is your annual?
Last year we did, I think, 2250 barrels.
It's respectable.
So we've had growth every single year. So as far as a market saturation point, us personally, we're still growing, but we're not, we added the first new tank we've had in 3 years. So we've just been trying to tweak out an extra handful of percent volume wise out of our brewery each year, just from an owner perspective. As costs go up by a handful percent every year, we need to sell a handful percent more beer to make up for those costs. Or you raise your prices. It's one or the other. People are like, well, how do you, well, you either raise your prices or you make more beer, one or the other.
Yeah. Tony from Stone's Throw and I were talking, he was talking about the, as he saw it, the soon to be demise of the $5 beer.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we were, I'm not positive about this, but we just raised our, now we don't do happy hour, but people are like, you do happy hour. We're like, yeah, we try and keep our pints a reasonable price. We were.
Look at all the beers that we produce. Like,
exactly. But we, our beers are our lowest price beer, our main tier, which has an IPA, a stout, a Belgian ale, all that. They were $4.75 until last month. And that's including tax. So really for us, like if you went to a restaurant, that'd be like a $4.25 craft beer plus tax.
Yeah.
You don't see craft beer for $4.25 anywhere. So we don't do happy hour, but
hops are not cheap these days.
No, they're not. And everything, that's all going up by a lot at a lot quicker pace than the prices that were increasing, our beers. But we just went up to $5 and I think we might've been the death of the sub 5 pint of beer in Bellingham. I don't know if there's a, at least brewery wise, I can't speak for all of the tap houses and that sort of thing. But I don't know if there's anywhere else that had craft beer outside of happy hour, like standard pints below $5.
Yeah.
Someone said that to me. They're like, I think you were the last one that was below $5 in Bellingham. I'm like, oh, we might be, well, we're 5 now, but
yeah.
But camaraderie wise. So there was the kind of the big 5, if you will, that we were going in. Of course you have Jorgensen out at North Fork and you got all that too. But there was a really healthy camaraderie because it was manageable. We got together and did a Bellingham Beer Week. You know, Gruff came along not long after that. And then before you know Stone's Throw was in and Structures. But it started growing and it just became less manageable. We used to do a Bellingham Beer Week beer. We had to get 5 breweries together and it was simple. Jorgensen, Hapsen, or 6. It was simple. Now with all the breweries are, it's just by pure, just by the
logistics.
Pure logistics. It's not, the camaraderie is not there as a factor of the number of people. And
everybody's busy running businesses.
And it is more competitive than it used to be. It's never been easy to sell beer in Bellingham when you're going up against some of the big regional breweries and then macro beer. But it's even more difficult now because all of us small players, even the people smaller than us, everyone's trying to get tap handles and restaurants. You know, the grocery store might throw an extra case of beer on the end or a little extra cooler space toward beer, which most of them have kind of maxed out now. But a lot of the restaurants in town, they only have so many handles. You know, the same place that we were selling beer to 5 years ago when we opened that had 6 handles, they still have 6 handles, but we went from 4 breweries to 14 or whatever we have now.
Yeah. And they want to keep it simple. And they don't want to have to think about it too
hard. And a lot of them too, they look at distributors. They're just like, should I just order through a distributor and write one check rather than writing 6 checks to 6 different parties and 6 different breweries and writing 6 different orders and 6 different emails and all that. So, you can feel it getting tight out there for sure. People are like, hey, the mantra of mine used to be, and what a lot of people said was, as long as it's good craft beer, we'll be fine. Right now though, I mean, the consumer's pretty driven by branding is huge, packaging, social media, excitement, a lot of that, where it used to be more driven by, they have the best IPA in town. That's why I buy their beer. Or they have I love their stout or their scotch ale or whatever it was.
But see, now, I still think that way, but then, you know,
You're old school, Dave. We're old guard. Yeah. And I've only been in it for 5 years. So yeah. You've been in it longer than that.
I've been out of it for longer than that, yeah, though, too. Well, yeah. Yeah.
But yeah. There's so much more that goes into it mm-hmm. now. And, yeah. You know, it's how do you pick a beer out on the shelf at the grocery store when so many of them are one-offs and seasonal? Well, either you know the brewery or the flashy packaging catches your eye. And then social media now is huge, too. Mm-hmm. Excitement, you know, and that sort of thing. So it's getting tight. We're starting to see closures of some older breweries and then some younger ones too. Like you said, Burnside too, mm-hmm. which was, I think maybe 7 years old-ish, I think.
Yeah. Somewhere between five and eight, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's getting tight. I think we're going to see more. I mean, I think this is mm-hmm. just the start. I don't want to sound negative.
Adapt or perish, essentially. Yeah,
exactly. You know? And that's the thing too. People need to, I think, be willing to adapt, and breweries mm-hmm. need to, you know, we listen to our brewers and our taste room staff and what gets them excited and what they want to brew and what they think as well. And we also listen to the consumer. There's people that push back on the hazy IPA, mm-hmm. you know, wave that came through and held out. 'Cause no, we don't want to do that. And at the end of the day, if that's what the consumer wants, we are here to make beer for the consumer.
Yeah.
It's not
always about you as a brewer.
No, we have payroll and we have lights to keep on. Mm-hmm. So we make beer that makes us, we make beer that makes us excited, but we also need to listen to the consumer. And we've seen breweries that have not been willing to adapt to that have said, no, we have these 5 year round beers that have been crushing it for 23 years and they didn't adapt quick enough. And then they adapt and it's a little too late and mm-hmm. it doesn't work out.
Yeah.
It is, from a brewery owner standpoint, though, I mean, both locally within Bellingham and then within the state of Washington, we distribute up and down I-5 corridor, pretty mm-hmm. much down to, well, pretty much down to Vancouver. We push beer we push beer into Portland. We just sent two pallets of beer out to Portland today. It's getting tighter. You can mm-hmm. feel it.
Yeah. Oh, I can't imagine trying to fight for shelf space now.
Yeah. And we have a consumer that wants new. They want one-offs and they want a new IPA. Even there's breweries out there that make the same IPA basically over and over again and put a different stamp on it. Mm-hmm. But that's what the consumer wants. So that's what those breweries do. And we also have a consumer that wants hyper local, right? So our Bellingham people like drinking hyper local beer, but they also want what's new and different and changing. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, we can only make so much local that's changing. We can only make so many beers. So then they want, well, what's changing from the brewery from Seattle? Mm-hmm. So, you know, I almost see like, people wanting new and different starting to trump the hyper local. 'Cause it's like, well, we can only put out a new beer once a week and you've already had your one beer this week. So instead of buying another one of that, you want to try the new beer from our good friends down at Fremont mm-hmm. or Georgetown or wherever. And they make great beer down there, but people want,
again,
what's
we're
new.
Spoiled. Like, yeah. We're spoiled a lot of good
incredibly,
beer.
Yeah. But people want what's new. And, I think a lot of that's pushing them to try beer that's maybe not mm-hmm. local anymore. It's an interesting kind of dynamic.
Yeah. You know, you were talking earlier about how social media is such a huge driver of what people buy and what people want. I remember people being just super loyal to a brewery. Like, you know, I mean, my main experience locally is Boundary Bay. You know, people would only go there once everything else started opening, especially, you know, Chuckanut was the first and then they were the polar opposite. You know, Will had the vision of doing world-class lagers, which to his credit, he's totally pulled off.
Yes.
And, but you know, it was a hard sell. Like it was a long road for him, even though he was, you know, small brewery of the year, you know, and winning all these awards, nobody really wanted to drink it. And that's come full circle now. And rightfully so. But do you like I guess my ultimate question is, when you're talking to people in the tap room, are there people who are like, this is the only place I come, I love you guys, like I'm a wander person through and through? Or do you find that most people
I think people make the rounds, and
we
have a lot of crossover between us and Kolschen mm-hmm. and Dave Vitt, who's one of the owners at Kolschen, is a good friend of ours, and we are incredibly indebted to him for helping us get going and everything from giving
advice.
Great
human being.
Great person. Yeah. To helping getting our tanks stood up and all of that. But we have crossover with them, and this is someone helping us get going, that knowing that we are going to eat out a little bit of of their patrons, but I think we also feed off of each other. Mm-hmm. When we left Seattle to move up here, the last thing that Ryan Hilliard, who owned Hilliard's Brewery, where I first worked, told me was, don't be afraid to go in close to other breweries. Cause we all know what Ballard is like now. Mm-hmm. He's like, at first people might be like apprehensive, but he said they feed off of
you're
each
creating
other.
A spot. For
yeah.
People
and I'm like, well, I'm going into a town with only three breweries. Why are you telling me this, Ryan? But now it kind of like, yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
And people like to go to places where there are multiple breweries. And we had an incredibly busy weekend this past weekend. And a lot of it, yeah, people were just getting done with the snowstorm.
Yeah, a lot of snow
on the ground. And we do have President's Day going on, but it was also family weekend up in Canada where they have off Monday. We were slammed with Canadian folks.
That explains why the trains were sold out too.
There you go. And they're exactly. And they're coming down here because there's multiple breweries here. Mm-hmm. Now, they may have five beers on a Saturday afternoon at five different breweries. But if it weren't for all five of you, you would have none. Mm-hmm. So do you want one and then have them go elsewhere? Or is that person not going to come to town? You're going to have zero. It's good, Dave.
Oh, nice.
I like that.
Yeah.
The spice is nice. We're drinking a Mexican stout that Dave made. I don't know
why. Yeah, a little Mexican chocolate stout.
That's nice. Yeah.
Lagrimas de Escuela.
A little bit of richness and then a little bit of spice in there. The spice is nice. I like the level.
Yeah, it's got a lot of flaked barley in it. So it was super thick already. And then, I added some jalapeno infused rum that by itself is undrinkable.
Yep.
that a friend of mine made.
Dessert stout.
And then some cinnamon and then some Mexican drinking chocolate.
Nice.
So
yeah, spicy beers are hard. I like a spicy beer that if someone doesn't like spices, they can still at least have a taster of
it. It's not just hot for hot's sake.
So the fun questions here.
We're getting to the wrap it up here and just having some fun stuff. What's your favorite beer to brew?
I like brewing stout.
Mm-hmm.
We don't get to brew it a lot because it's a stout and, mm-hmm. We brew it a handful of times a year. It's my favorite beer. That beer won a gold at GABF, which I love because it's my favorite beer. And I actually feel like it's one of those styles that we actually do very well when it comes to the actual style guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that because a lot of our beers, even like our Wander Ale, our Belgian Blonde, it doesn't really fit. It's not like a golden ale. It's not like a Belgian Blonde. It's got some weed in it. Definitely not a Belgian wit. And it kind of floats in no man's land, but I really like brewing our stout. I like drinking stout. Our stout's 6.4%. It's an export stout.
Mm-hmm.
So it has a nice little hit to it, but it's not so big that you can't have a pint for it at the end of the day and feel, it's not like you're
this is like
drinking a 7 or 8%.
5%, 6%.
Yep. Yeah. I like a nice, really easy drinking upper 4s, 5% like dry stout. And then our export stout. I just found that everyone's brewing when we first started brewing stout 5 years ago. Everyone's doing imperial stouts and they're doing dry stouts. I'm like, where's this middle ground stout? Because I want to have a little kick in it, but not a lot of people do export stouts. So I love brewing that beer. I like the smell of the mash, all the specialty malt we have in there, the roastiness.
Mm-hmm.
There's some carafa in there. It's just really
the smell of the pale chocolate malt. It's just.
So I like brewing stout.
That's fun. Nice.
And we don't need to dry hop it. So that's awesome too.
it's an inexpensive beer to make. Yes. No late hop additions.
No, like pretty straightforward.
5 pounds. What's your favorite beer to drink? And you might've just answered that.
Yeah, probably stout. Probably correspondent stout. I mean, it's my favorite to brew, favorite to drink. Mm-hmm. I really like having small glasses of our sour beers, mm-hmm. Just 8 or 10 ounces of our sour beers, our fruited sours. I really like Orval. It's kind of since spending a little time in Belgium, and I've just really been turned on to Orval. If I'm just getting a bottle at the bottle shop,
Did you wander around the ruins?
No, it was on our list.
Yeah, but it's out of
that
the way.
Did not happen.
It's out of
it
the
is
way.
A little.
Yeah,
out
you
got
to rent a car to get.
But
down there.
But no, we did make some rounds, and we drank. We drank Creek and we drank Pesh and we drank, in Belgium, we drank
all the things,
all the things,
Spirit
all the
Disneyland
Lambics. Yeah. It was fun, but I like Orval. If I can have one beer, non-water beer, I love Orval. If it's a water beer, it's usually stout.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Nice. What's your guilty pleasure as far as drinking wise goes? And it can be anything. It doesn't even have to be beer.
Yeah. Guilty pleasure. Probably a nice rosé.
Yeah.
Some nice, just chilled rosé.
Totally.
Yeah,
summertime.
I kind of alluded to that before.
Yeah, yeah. But you were talking about maybe how you were thinking winery at the beginning. Yeah.
Yep. And as we've grown older, we've also allowed ourselves to spend a little bit more money on wine. Because when we used to live by Trader Joe's and we were 24 years old and it was $2 chuck.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden we graduated to like $5 bottles of wine, six, seven, eight. Now it's like, okay, we could get a double digit, you know, bottle of wine. And,
this is a $12 bottle of wine.
And you find very quickly there's some really good quality bottles of wine out there for under $15.
Oh, absolutely.
But you can't be spending, well, you can, but you can't be spending six, you know, and wine, not always, but a lot of the times I found, which is actually refreshing. I feel like you get what you pay for a lot of times.
Yeah,
like glass of rosé in the summer. Like if you come over my house and catch me off guard, like ringing the doorbell at 7 o'clock on a Sunday night in the summer, you'd be like, are you drinking a glass of rosé on the porch? What are you doing?
Yeah. Well,
and I don't drink liquor, so I can't. Oh, yeah. I don't. I just never been drawn to it. If it's a wedding, I might have a glass, but otherwise I'm beer and wine.
Yeah.
I'm very much into also drinking at your locale, wherever you are.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean, if I'm in Northern California, I might be drinking more wine. If mm-hmm. I'm in, you know, if I'm in Hawaii, I'm drinking Maui Brewing Company. You know,
yeah, what's
if I'm,
indigenous to this region.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah,
you know, and exactly. If I'm in Mexico, yeah, I might get a frozen drink with tequila in it.
Mm-hmm.
Not that frozen drinks are a really great representation of Mexico, but you know what I'm saying. But I'm on the beach.
Hot. Yes. Yeah, one is 90% humidity and 100 degrees. Yeah.
Negro Modelo or whatever. Yeah. Love the local stuff.
Yeah. So this is my favorite question because this was the original. This is the impetus for this whole podcast is mm-hmm. I was originally going to call it flipping the switch. What is the beer that flipped the switch for you? What was the beer where you drank it and you're like, I need to know how to do this?
Yeah. There's a couple. At our wedding, we served Anchor Steam and we served Sierra. San Francisco is very close to Lake Tahoe for those who aren't familiar. So we used to go up to Lake Tahoe and we had a ski lease up there. There was like 17 of us that piled into a 3-bedroom. So we had season passes up at Tahoe for four or five seasons that we lived in San Francisco. And at the after ski down, come down the mountain at the bottom of the mountain, they had, you know, open bonfire and we just drank Sierra Nevada, Sierra, 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 big, 32-ounce massive glasses of Sierra Nevada.
Mm-hmm.
So Sierra Nevada probably was the ultimate one that did it for me. Rogue Amber Ale in Anchor Steam too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sierra Nevada, I don't think I've done an interview with a brewer where Sierra Nevada has not been mentioned as one of the...
It's just the quintessential.
Yeah.
I mean, whenever I think, when people are like, when you talk about hops, they talk about Cascade hops, I'm like, it's Sierra Nevada. Mm-hmm. Like there's professional connections in my mind to that beer. There's nostalgic connections from drinking it, skiing and drinking it on the rooftop when we lived in an apartment in San Francisco. There's connections with my wife. That's the beer we served at our wedding.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that beer is probably the one that really did it for me.
Tremendous love and respect for Sierra Nevada for so many reasons, but, do you have like a brewing hero or a brewery that, you know, not necessarily that you modeled Wander after, but you know, when you think back, you're like, that was my inspiration.
I mean, I learned a lot from the guys at Hilliard's mm-hmm, when I worked there.
Yeah.
Ryan Hilliard ran it. A guy named Todd, who now runs Craft Canning. Todd's the CEO now of Craft Canning, which is a mobile canning operation based out of Portland, which also has operations in Seattle. They do anyone that does mobile canning, mm-hmm. Not anyone. There's a couple large businesses, but most of them use Craft Canning. Those guys, there's another guy, Brian, that brewed with at Hilliard's. He's now a Beretta Legion.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they're all the Hilliard's people. I mean, they allowed me to come in part time and just basically get my hands dirty.
Makes total sense.
Yeah. So those guys really, and I learned a lot there. I think a lot of people, the first brewery you worked at probably influences you a lot. Locally, David, I mean, I know if anything ever happens, if I'm in trying to figure something out or something breaks or something falls, called Dave. Dave has so much knowledge.
Yeah, well, he's a fixer. I mean, he's a
fixer. You know, he's mechanically inclined for days. He's genuinely a good person.
Yeah.
I mean, but you can't stop there locally. Then you got Ed and Janet and you got Will and Mari.
I mean,
you got everyone.
Yeah,
I mean, it's amazing. We don't have I don't think we have the camaraderie we used to, but I don't want that to come off in a negative way. It's just we're all really busy.
Yeah.
I know at any time I can call Mari or I can call Dave or I can call Janet and they will lend a hand if there's, if you need help with something, you need a question. We still all trade grain. We trade hops. We share yeast. Just everyone's just really busy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Boundary's always been all about community.
Yep.
You know, boundary, and not that everybody else isn't, but I mean.
What Boundary does, and I honestly, a lot of us realize it, but I don't know if the community as a whole does. I mean, the amount of philanthropical work and support that Boundary does year after year after year after year, it is astounding. Mm-hmm.
All right. So now really, really fun stuff. These are my, these are my favorite questions. Okay. What's your favorite grain?
Favorite grain?
Yeah.
Probably Munich.
Munich?
Yeah. I just love Munich malt. I love Weyermann. I'm a big champion of Weyermann malt. And I just love Weyermann dark Munich. Just that really.
What's the lava bond on that?
I think it's, they give range on everything. I think it's like 12 to 14 or something. Yeah. Their dark Munich is not really that dark.
Yeah.
There are some other dark Munichs.
For reference's sake, your average pale malt's like anywhere from 1.5 to 2.
Yep. And I think normal Munich, I want to say, God, I have to look at the sheets. I want to say it's like 6 to 8 or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's just, but it's just this.
Good flavor, good color.
It's rich. Yeah.
Good extraction, you know?
Yep. Yeah. It's just, I mean, you can brew a, you can brew a beer with all Munich. Mm-hmm. I mean, people do that all the time, but we use it in smaller amounts, 10, 20% in a lot of beers. And then just the history of Weyermann and the quality that they deliver, consistency. It's amazing. We're a hyper local brewery. All of our fabrication site in Washington.
We use
Marks out of Vancouver, Washington. We use mostly all domestic hops, you know, obviously domestic yeast and water sourced locally, but and most of our malt is from North America. A lot of it's from Pacific Northwest, a little bit from Canada, but when we do go outside of the country, it's Weyermann. It's just world.
I mean, if you're looking for authenticity, you know, there's a difference, you know, between spring, you know, wheat and winter wheat.
Yep. And they've been doing just it like for generations, flour, and, generations and generations and generations and generations.
They got a dial.
They know what they're doing.
Yep. What's your favorite hop?
Favorite hop? Probably El Dorado. Oh. I like El Dorado.
Describe El Dorado. How would you describe it?
I always get rock candy off it.
Interesting.
Almost like a rock candy Jolly Rancher flavor off it, which to me is very unique. We've done Eldo, which is our fresh hop beer. Eldo is kind of a short term for El Dorado.
Yeah, haven't heard that.
If you're talking to the hop growers and the farmers, they'll talk about Eldo. When are we harvesting Eldo instead of saying El Dorado?
Nice. All right.
So we made a fresh hop beer.
Sounds very Tolkien-y.
Yeah, exactly. It does. We made a fresh hop beer called Eldo, which in a roundabout way, we weren't going to do fresh hop beer the first year we opened. We opened in May, did our first brewing in March, opened in May, taste room opened in May, fresh hop season's in September. I get a call from Dave Vitt and he says, I got a truck full of Eldo hops. Do you want them for a fresh hop? I'd already milled in that day for a brew the next day to make Shootoss, which is our house IPA for people who don't know that.
With a little bit of rye in it, which
with a little bit of rye in it, yes. And I said, yes, bring it. We're going to make a fresh hop beer this year because you have it. And I'm like, wait, why do you have this? And he goes, well, we placed our order for our fresh hops with a farmer and they gave us the wrong hops, but they'd already pulled them from the kiln because when you get fresh hops, they're wet. People also call them wet hops. They haven't went through the kiln yet. They'd already pulled them though and put them in sacks. At this point, they can't unsack them, throw them back in the kiln. It's not worth it. It's just too much of a mess. And they've been sitting out for, you know, a couple hours. So he goes, basically, they just said, hey, we screwed up the order. Here's your hops. And we got these extra Eldos for you as well. So Dave said, well, we need a home for them. They're like, can you find a home for them? If you guys can't, we're literally going to throw them out back and compost them because it's a few hundred pounds of hops.
Yeah.
So Dave called me and I said, yeah, we'll definitely take them. So we ended up making a batch of Shootoss with Eldo. And that was our first fresh hop beer. And then we've been getting Eldo every year since.
Nice.
And I just like El Dorado. We contract in pellet form. So we use it in a lot of our year round or not year round. A lot of our beers we make year throughout the year that are one-off IPAs. And then we always do a fresh hop with it.
So. What's the alpha on that? Like, are they pretty big Eldo, or are they medium?
It's medium big. We use it all finishing though. We don't use it really dual purpose. We don't bitter with it. We bitter primarily with German Magnum.
Yeah.
Actually, it's kind of our main one.
That's
Magnum's just clean. Yeah. We use it on a lot for bittering.
It's totally nice. Well, speaking of yeast, what's your favorite yeast? Because you use a few yeasts, right? I mean, you got a Belgian and just a regular American ale.
Belgian yeast, we've switched up a little bit. Chimay is probably my favorite yeast. It's Abbey 1 from Y Yeast.
I think 1214 with Y Yeast.
Yes.
The number.
Good good memory. And with Imperial, who's another wine supplier, is called Gnome. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I probably should have made yeast. I really like.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had a bar called the Buccaneer when we lived in San Francisco, which was just up the hill from us, and it had a pirate theme. It was on Polk Street. It was kind of a dark bar with a jukebox and a pool table. Yeah,
which is my favorite bars.
Yeah. And they had always had Anderson Valley on tap. Boot Amber Ale, mm-hmm. if you remember, you used to drink Boot Amber Ale back in the day, and a couple other beers, and they'd always have Chimay on, Chimay Red. So mm-hmm. usually after happy hour pitchers, last beer before going home, I get a Chimay, and I just really
enjoy Chimay. So good. One of the last few questions. I say this every podcast. I'm sure people are tired of hearing it, but I feel that I need to give credit where credit's due. I totally ripped this question off from a now defunct podcast called The Dinner Party Download. And they used to ask every guest, tell us something that we don't know. Mm-hmm. And it can be about you or something random, you know, a random piece of trivia. It could be anything.
Yeah.
And just tell us something that we don't know.
We were just joking in the office last week about how hard the question is. So tell me something interesting about yourself. One time I was traveling with a couple other guys and this girl asked us all that. And we were like, I have no idea what to say. I'm from Iowa. But tell us something you don't know. We already touched on it. So say, well, I have an engineering degree. I'm fascinated with engineering and numbers and that sort of thing. I got one thing I do, and I don't even know if a lot of my staff knows this. A couple of them do, but the day we brew a beer, and this came from Hilliard's, mm-hmm. and Todd, who was the head brewer at Hilliard's, said, what are you drinking? And you drank the beer that you made that day.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes you don't always have it, but if we brew stout one day, usually we have the previous batch on.
Yeah,
it's really nice homage. To drink the finish product of the beer that you just brewed that day and that you smelt and that you transferred and did this whole process and tasting what the batch like it before tasted like.
Yeah. It's paying respect to that and like having it in your brain, like this is what I'm doing.
So that's kind of something fun that I do. I don't know outside of Hilliard's, I haven't heard of other breweries really doing that, but yeah, drinking the beer that you brewed that day that's mm-hmm. currently on tap, just having it right after you brewed it is kind of a fun little thing I've tried to do. And I don't even know if a lot of my staff know I do that, but I'll be like, what do you have in chat? And if we brewed Wanderer that day, I'll get that. I know a couple of the brewers I think know that, but I'm not sure.
Yeah. You know, when you're in mid sentence, I was thinking about it, and actually I pretty much asked that question right off the bat. Like, how do you pronounce your last name?
Yeah. Or that's been a fun one. There you go.
Tell us something that nobody knows. Yeah, like how to pronounce your last name. Yeah.
There you go. That would have been easy.
So, you know, obviously Wander's a success and you guys are doing great. So many awards, too numerous to mention, like a small brew pub of the year or small brewery of the year, brewery or is it beer. Medium?
We're considered large.
You're considered large.
Large is over 18. It was either 1800 or 2000. Large for the state of Washington.
Okay.
We're at 22. So we're all of a sudden large.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which people are like, oh my gosh, you're large. And it's like, I didn't draw the qualifications. I think of us as like a big, small or a small, medium.
But, a big, small brewery.
Yeah. But everything above 2000 at the Washington Beer Awards is considered large. So we won.
Yeah.
Was it seven? You can submit 10 beers. So we submitted 10 and we won 7 awards. So we got large brewery of the year. So it was great.
Yeah. Nice work. Yeah. So on that kind of thing, is there any advice that you would have for people who want to be where you are right now or are in the midst of working towards being that?
Yeah, I think, and this is advice from Dave Vitt, who mm-hmm. we've kind of talked about at Kolschen. One thing he told me when I was opening a brewery, he said, if you want to be if you want to brew beer, be a brewer. If you want to, how'd it go? Let me rephrase that. He said, no, what he that was him explaining it. The actual mm-hmm. statement was, if you want to brew beer, don't open a brewery.
Right.
And
he told us
essentially,
that too.
yes, essentially what Dave is saying, which I've shared with a lot of other people because it rings so true, is if you want to be a brewer and you want to brew craft beer and you're passionate about brewing and production, go be a production brewer. Whether it's a shift brewer at a large brewery or a hands-on brewer at a really small brewery doing one-offs or whatever it is, opening a brewery, you become a business owner.
Mm-hmm.
My time is mostly taken up with emails, dealing with vendors, billing, paying bills, contracting, all of that stuff. I'm still officially the head brewer at Wander, even though I have 3 brewers that do an amazing job and do most all of the production.
Mm-hmm.
Every now and then I'll fill out on the floor doing something. I'm there every single day sitting in the office.
For a special one-off or something.
Yeah, that stares directly at the brew house and people are asking me questions from the production floor.
I used to do that.
Yeah, but you're a business owner now, and mm-hmm. that's with Colleen running the whole backside. I'm still just on the production side. It's still, I'm basically 90% business focused. So that's kind of my advice coming from Dave is if you do want to open a brewery, be prepared to be a business owner. If you mm-hmm. really genuinely love the hands-on production aspect of brewing craft beer and making craft beer, then be a brewer.
Yeah. Make $15 an hour and be a brewer.
Go be a brewer. Yes, yeah. Yes. Hopefully better than that.
Yeah, that is very true. And that was one of the struggles that I went through. And especially once Chris was out of Subdued, I was like, okay, this is just me. Like, I'm not a business guy.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to do that. I just want to make beer.
And it's eye opening. Cause you think about, oh yeah, we got to contract hops and I got to place my orders for this. And now we're going to have to, you know, pay our water bill. But mm-hmm. the amount of stuff that goes along with the business.
Running a business is you just basically write checks for a living. That's what you do.
That's exactly what, write checks and then negotiate pricing. Checks. And then, And then if there's an issue, you deal with the issues.
Yeah.
You pay checks and deal with issues. You put out fires, you mm-hmm. know, you deal with leaky roofs, you deal with, you know, if there's a customer complaint or, you know, if there's something you have to work out with an employee or whatever. I mean, mm-hmm. it's really quickly, as soon as we start bringing on
you
employees,
are the face.
You have to shift to running the brewery, which is not brewing beer. Mm-hmm. But in the same sense, I still get to review all the recipes. I get to still create recipes. I still order all the grain. I order all the hops every week. I still do all of that.
Yeah.
But, that's one thing I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Very distinctly different things, brewing beer and owning a brewery.
Yeah. I remember talking to Josh Freem a few years ago. And at this point, Freem Brewing had been operating for at least 2 years, probably 3 years. And we were just talking and I was like, it's running a brewery. It's not all about the beer. And I was just about to say, but it is all about the beer. And he totally interrupted. He's like, but it is all about the beer.
Yep.
You know, he's like, you can never lose sight of that. And I was like, how do you juggle that? It's not easy. I have tremendous respect for you.
Don't ever look at a brewery owner and be like, why did they hire a head brewer? Why aren't they still the head brewer? Did they mm-hmm. lose the passion? Why? Because I thought that was some brewery owners I knew. I was like, why did they? I'll never let go of being...
Yeah.
Being the head brewer and being hands-on brewing the beer. Like, that's mm-hmm. what I love about it's like they didn't have a choice.
Right. Yeah.
They had to do that in order for the business
to stay viable. If your business is successful.
And successful.
You're doing
if
that.
If you do your job and your business is successful, you will not be brewing.
You will be doing more administrative work.
Yeah. As much as you don't like that, that's mm-hmm. what it is.
Yep. So. And that's why, having Patrick and Chris was like, I'll run the brewery.
Yep.
Like, I'll pay the taxes. I'll do the ordering.
I'll fill out spreadsheets.
All that. Yeah. Well, thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me. This was enjoyable.
Yeah. Super fun. It was good to sit down with you. And I mean, I've known you for a long time, but I don't
we ever sat down one-on-one.
Yeah, we have not sat down one-on-one for sure.
Hopefully everyone found it entertaining.
Worthwhile. So hopefully I asked good questions, but is there anything that I didn't mention that you'd want to add? Any last?
We have our fifth anniversary in May. That's big for us. Yeah.
Nice. So when in May?
The first weekend in May, which I want to say is I want to say it's like the fourth. So we'll have that. We'll be celebrating that. That'll be good.
Congratulations on that. Yeah.
Definitely.
Great.
All right. Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah. Thanks for sitting down. Let's have a little bit more beer.
Yes. Cheers.
All right.
Woo! Awesome, Dave. That was good. Yeah. Cheers, Dave. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
I had a great time sitting down with Mr. Keel and filling in the details of his and Colleen's path to now and Wander in general. And that pineapple IPA was delicious. And I really hope that you got some. It may still be around. I'm not sure. Although it's still a bit away, don't forget about their anniversary coming up on May 4th. I actually have that day off, and I'm planning to brew in the morning and then go celebrate with them in the afternoon, so maybe I'll see you there. As always, if there's someone you'd like me to sit down with, please let me know. And now, you actually can. I have a new email address. You can reach me directly at dave@taptrail.com. So hit me up with questions or comments, even ones about the podcast if you want. If you enjoy Tapped In, please take a moment to rate us with all the stars on your podcast service of choice. It makes a big difference in where we can be heard and whether this experiment will be able to continue or not. I've got some exciting conversations scheduled, so make sure and subscribe so you don't miss out. The goal is to release one per month. I'll expect you to do your homework in between and drink some beer. Thanks again for listening and spreading the word, and I'll talk to you soon. Cheers.